Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Today we're going to loop back on something that was actually lightly referred to in episode 2 of Evolution, but it's something that's coming up over and over among my friends. And I think it would be very interesting to talk about it in our traditional formats, which is alien splicing. The alien engineering of humans. So people call it the alien drop-off. Now, to put that in perspective, I'm going to go to a very specific time in the history of what we believe to be truthful anthropological studies, which really kind of comes up to an era of a lot of shiesty stuff, such as the, I guess you could call the entire era of paleontology. But it has to do with the missing link. Again, for those of you who didn't watch episode 2, don't worry. We're going to recap everything here. And then we're going to do a deep dive on what it means. Most of you who have studied the origins of man know that you have been told about a missing link. And it's always portrayed as a single bone that goes from the previous inhabitants of this world, the bipedal sort of primates, even if they use their knuckles a little bit. And then all of a sudden there's a deviation, a Y. And you have Homo sapien, and you have hominid, which is more like your Yeti Bigfoot, right? The scientific problem with what you're told as a kid, and of course they've got Lucy and they got all these bones and they've all been put together by the biggest freaking liars on planet Earth. The amount of bones that we have, supposedly, and again, this entire presentation from anthropology could be sort of put together by liars. They have found a bunch of bones where, of course, the brain cavity of mankind is very small. You know, the brow is very large. The mouth is very round, sort of like a chimpanzee gorilla mouth. And they're saying, look, all of these bones prove evolution. Now, quite frankly, they could prove evolution. They could merely be different species living at the same time, and someone has merely related them by lining them up. You know, I know plenty of people who absolutely shit themselves over evolution because they feel like that negates God. I don't feel that way at all, but I don't also have any need to believe in evolution over creationism. I just don't have any need for it. I keep my eyes open. But this argument that there are a bunch of skulls that lead up to the missing link is visually fairly intuitive, but I don't know where those bones have been discovered. None of us really have the records of each one of the skulls and, you know, where were they found in relation to sedimentary rock, location. I'm sure some folks know this, but it's a lot of taking the word of another man at a time when evolution was becoming a hugely powerful movement in the 1800s, right? You know, the famous Lucy skeleton has been almost entirely debunked as a traditional primate, and when they laid the bones inside the little anthropology bed, they uprighted the rib cage and adjusted the fingers as in relation to the kneecaps. I mean, it was really just a hoax. And what's interesting is that when you get inside the mind of man and you make them believe that this is true, and all you have to do is discover it, unlike mathematics, right? Man will get to a point where he or she will devote their entire lives to a movement, or at least the formative years of their professional academia, meaning they go off and try to look for king tut for 20 years. And they get to a point of utter desperation, because to fail when all you have is a left brain academic to prove to the world that you have learned something, there's nothing more terrifying than not only coming back with nothing, which is pretty terrifying in itself, but to be proven that the inner workings of your brain aren't put together very well, and you're dumb, you're stupid, etc., etc. Now, the reality is the person isn't dumb. The person read materials, gained a hypothesis, and did us all a favor in figuring out whether or not it was true or not. That has its value as well, right? But again, we don't have any unknown disciplines in college. We have theoretical disciplines, which is close. But we don't have any rewards for someone to find out that there's a negative. You know, if somebody said, oh, you know, it's a Pacific Rim theme, and someone said, oh my God, do we have interdimensional doors at the bottom of the ocean? And a bunch of scientists jumped in submarines and they went down to the bottom of the ocean and they took incredibly detailed pictures and ran all kinds of scans and came up and said, nope, it's just the bottom of the ocean. Then the world will go, hooray, yay, big giant Pacific Rim monsters aren't coming out of the bottom of the ocean. But if you go off and try to find the missing link or links to the missing link and you come back zero, you're a failure. And that stimulates the notion of fraud. To save humanity, to save yourself. So get back to the missing link. You have a series of skulls. I believe it's in the 30s, but there are literally hundreds of similar skulls, so they just kind of pick one that mutates up to this gap. The gap, again, when I was a child in the 70s, they always kind of made it feel like there was a single skull that was missing between the last hominid and the Homo sapien. It's really like Neanderthal, blah, blah, blah. It's very similar. But I recently, in the last 2 years, probably even 3 years, watched a presentation by an anthropologist who said he believed that it was possible for a Bigfoot to exist. But that wasn't the interesting part of the presentation. The interesting part was it was the very first time I'd ever seen anyone really show the interior of a Homo sapiens skull as related to his supposedly predecessors. All other primates, whether they be Neanderthal, actual primates, hominids, yetis, Bigfoots, the inside of the skull is very primitive. For them, it is essentially just a big hollow chamber. The muscle tissue inside those chambers, I should say, have only the innate ability to howl. It's like a monkey howls. Even if they can modulate it a little bit, they cannot make syllables like I just did. They can't make a syllable on the tip of their tongue. They can't roll the R. And therefore, we become, just phonetically speaking, absolutely, positively phenomenal beings. Obviously, the proportion of skull allocation increased for the brain cavity. All of a sudden, our brains grew into that cavity, which, if you think about it, there's a lot of genetics going on. There's an intelligent design going on a level that's just crazy. So I want to pull these things out because we need to grasp how massive Homo sapien is compared to its theorized cousins. Now, according to anthropologists, they say that, at least some of them, they say that even though the Homo sapien and the gorilla look the same, they say there is not a single primate bone inside a Homo sapien. There's no hominid bones inside Homo sapien. We have completely redesigned bones from the tip of our toes to the top of our skull plates. The thing is, with this missing link, is that we're not only missing any genetic connection between these primates and us. We're missing our own evolutionary system. We're missing everything. Now, there are books that suggest that the hominids supposedly were living in arid conditions, which doesn't make any sense at all, but they were living in arid conditions without a lot of other predators, and that in order to become more intelligent, we moved into the jungles, we moved into the rainforests, and this, one of the two, is where we had a huge epiphany and we exploded into what we are. And because those are such hostile environments, that every time a human died, every time a hominid human evolutionary chain animal died, that all of its bones were entirely consumed, and we have never, ever, ever found any of them. I want you to think about that. Not one. The odds of that are astronomically against. One, that these hominids supposedly ran around a desert is ridiculous, because the less intelligent a creature is, the more primitive the food supply has to be. It has to be painfully obvious, eat this, drink this, because if you don't have that, they don't survive. And then, to the degree that they multiply and become great in number, whatever you are eating has to be naturally more than your population, such that there's always just ample supply for an ignorant creature to consume of the plant life that will keep it alive, right? Or to kill something to keep it alive. Now, I want to loop back to something that always interests me a lot, which is 2001 A Space Odyssey, written by Arthur C. Clarke. For those of you who haven't seen it, the very first act of this movie is about primitive man. And again, forget being angry about evolution, because there's something in here that's for either camp. But the monolith arrives, and it lets itself get sort of discovered one morning. And the monkeys go up to it and touch it. It's singing, sort of, and they're all freaked out. And then one of the monkeys is just having fun with a bone. He's got like a femur bone or something, and he's sort of just tapping the carcass of one of the animals that has naturally died in front of his face. And we cut back to the monolith, and there's obviously some information download going on, or it's already been downloaded. We don't really understand how much time has elapsed, but he starts to pound on these bones with this femur and starts realizing that there's a natural handle on the part of the femur that goes into the ball joint, and he just starts beating the shit out of these things. He's already lost a water hole to another group of monkeys on the other side, sort of primitive man monkey. And he realizes he can go back and take that water hole with a bone. But the first step is, before he goes back and gets the water hole, he kills one of these boars and eats it. And it's eating red meat. There has to be a transition for all animals to go from being leaf eaters to being meat eaters. There just is. It happens. I'm not sure anything starts out being a meat eater besides perhaps a bacteria that eats flesh, right? So I think that there are nutritional differences and changes. But you'll have vegetarians that write books, which I own one of them, where they say that, you know, the explosion of man's brain is the vegetarian adoption, which would have been its initial adoption. Now, we know that animals that eat pure vegetarian diets are some of the stupidest animals on planet Earth. The panda and the koala might be the two dumbest beings that are cute and fuzzy with eyeballs. And they have a strict linear diet. Again, your koala, you could pull off the leaves off the tree that he likes to eat, put it on a plate in front of him, and he doesn't know what it is. You know, sloth isn't that much more brilliant, right? So we have a bone change. We have a massive bone change in human beings. The skull is redesigned to a level that is utterly phenomenal, with, it would seem, a purpose. The purpose of phonetic communication, which is very, very interesting, right? Because if the communication between two beings is merely a how, then you have to live in almost a telepathic realm to communicate. But then there's the chicken and the egg problem, that if you're not able to articulate different variants of emotion through perhaps what we might call an iconic language or a phonetic language, then how highly developed can our brains actually get? So it would seem that the imperative of our design is to be able to communicate in an individual, you know, emotional packets called words. Whether we draw a picture of something and say, this picture plus that picture means what I feel, blah, 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 or whether it is phonetically necessary. to communicate in individual words. But the other one is that the brain cavity is increased. And usually we just hear about that sort of thing and we go, yeah, well, so whatever. The way that bones move in a brain cavity technique is a lot different than how the bones move for the speech centers of the head. A brain that gets bigger genetically and sort of exudes pressure on the skull is the only way that the skull cavity gets bigger without direct tampering, right? But that would typically be how it works. The brain has more activity, and through more activity, it starts to push. The bones of the world and our bodies are very compliant to what's going on. So it starts to accept the push and grow geometrically, right? Now, the other thing about the skull is it is very unique to the rest of our body. Now, we have cartilage all over our body, right? We have, you know, noses and ears that are made of 100% cartilage links, right? Cartilage keeps all of our bones from growing together. Otherwise, our fingers would be one big stick, each one of them. But the brain cavity has a very interesting use of cartilage in that it keeps three plates apart from each other. That's where you get the little soft spot on kids' heads, right? This little three-way junction in your skull is a way that we probably avoid having migraines, avoid having a stunted growth because the plate in our skull would harden. There's a condition in children who are born without cartilage that they suffer so much damage from not growing with the brain's growth that the child passes away. So there's this amazing give and take relationship. We have a thinner skull plate than our hominid predecessors. So it doesn't look like to me that the redesign of man was anything related to evolution. It just doesn't. Because how do you evolve these various cavities? You could change a nutritional diet in man. He becomes more sentient. Again, meat proteins are always associated with a higher intelligence, with the improvement of the visual cortex, with the quality of our cells, etc., despite any of the bullshit you're told. So perhaps the brain merely needs a nutritional change. But how do you get this beautiful redesign of the phonetic part of the mouth? Well, one could say it's a luck of the draw. There was a weird coconut out there, and they started sort of eating this weird coconut, or this weird mango, or this weird fruit, and in chewing such a bizarre substance, it, over millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, it kept pushing and prodding on the interior of the mouth, and every single human being, or Homo sapien wannabe, was eating the same thing, and it just had this sticky, taffy nature to it. In order to swallow it all, we ended up pushing and prodding the inside of our mouth, and oh, lucky us, we have a phonetic design to the interior of our skull. Now, how ridiculous does that sound? I mean, I guess it's possible. I want to throw everything out there because you'll hear it from somebody if we don't. So what are all the alternatives to this theory? I mean, the weird part about this evolutionary argument is that even if we were spliced and created in a computer or whatever, who did it? Who did it, right? Is it a race of aliens above us? Is it God himself above us? Obviously, there are a lot of folks that feel very nervous about saying it's anything other than God, almost to the point of defensive guilt, which I completely understand. And so we have a really hard time framing the conversation. This particular conversation doesn't happen very often because a lot of folks don't know about this missing link issue. They don't know that the first true Homo sapiens skull was utterly redesigned, like, you know, sort of a solid stone that looks like a car, all the way up to an F1 race car with all kinds of goodies in it that can go 200 miles an hour around a corner. By the way, they're spraying the shit out of our Orange County today. So let's get into it. Let's get into some of the logical arguments and thought processes on how we could have been redesigned from what appears to be a predecessor on this planet, because that in itself is a very interesting circumstance. Now, anyone who listens to carbon dating and all that kind of stuff, you know that it's all with a grain of salt whether or not the object that's being dated really has its original materials in it, the carbon signatures in it. Was it carbon 18 or whatever it is? So either one of two things is true. Or I guess both of them could be true. But these seeming, you know, evolutionary predecessors, these Neanderthals, the hominids of various kinds, the primates of various kinds, those skulls could have actually existed before Homo sapien, which doesn't really affect our splicing story. So either they existed before, or they existed at the same time. We know sort of what existed after us, because we put them in cages and call them zoos. But now, who would do the splicing? Well, that kind of depends on what you think reality is, right? I think we have essentially three schools of thought that are genetically different when it comes to this question. There's some folks that believe we're on a flat Earth, which is a round disk, just like the just like a little drop of water, and there's firmament water over us, and God is right here, and God is participating, although he will not show himself any longer. He used to hang out here a lot. The second one is that it's essentially evolutionary model, something from nothing, Big Bang, and that we evolved out of the dust of the universe through sheer coincidence. Okay. It's your traditional evolutionary model. And your third model really gets down to a simulation of some sort. Whether you want to call it a computer simulation or whatever. This has been something that's been orchestrated by other folks. Higher than us. Could be Anunnaki. Arcanons. Could be gray aliens. Could be some other interdimensional species. Perhaps some reptilian thing. But that we are at the beck and call of someone else's hardware. All right. Well, let's go after the God one. The odd thing about the God algorithm is that God seemed to be playing around quite a bit before we were created. There seems to be obvious examples of life before us, and, you know, we'll take the dinosaurs and keep them out of this. But it could be we were all made at the same time, and it's simply the anthropologists that have theories that make them report things at different timelines. Let's just say that there were a few things before us. I mean, when I look at a beautiful creature in the universe, I see someone has been playing with great design. Like I said, it was that the dragon praying mantis is just a phenomenal being. But all these jungle birds where the male jungle birds have to entertain the females. Just the red robin, you know, his lady friend is brown. Someone was just generating just beautiful designs. A little neon fish, it's gorgeous. Etc., etc., right? So it would seem, if you just let go of any preconceived notions, that the in relation to everything that man creates on this world, which has interesting designs from all the automobiles we have and other items, that whoever created this world was way ahead of us. When you look at beautiful plants, I'm surrounded by gorgeous plants. When you look at a palm tree, give me a break. It's just a gorgeous thing. You know, it's a bush that keeps growing up and looks like a tree. But the only thing that makes me really curious about the God idea of it is that if God, as a singular creature, made mankind as Homo sapien, then there was a tremendous amount of experimentation before us. We don't need all these insects. We don't need all the animals that exist on the planet. We simply do not need them for us to exist. We don't need whales. We don't need elephants. We don't need wasps. I don't think we need flies either. And yet we have them. So either this is the sort of that shoebox of a master student storing all of their creations for us to see. Hey, you know, I did the Bengal tiger. It's pretty badass, isn't it? And then I made this cheetah thing, and it was even cooler. I just kind of reduced the frame a little bit, and I was really kind of going for speed. And then I did this lion thing that was king of the jungle. And it was all about predatorial. Look at the face of a lion and tell me that there isn't intelligent design in that thing. It is gorgeous. How is it that evolution would constantly be creating the most gorgeous things? Isn't it interesting that most of the species that survive a really long time, and yes, there's some ugly ass fish out there, depending on how you look at them, but everything seems to have usually this amazing beauty.